In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Here's a question I have not yet heard anyone ask. Why did it take Doge to expose this massive corruption scheme? Because when you think of all of the trillions of dollars of fraud and waste and abuse that Doge, that's the Department of Government Efficiency, has already found, and they've only been at it 3 weeks, think of how many people and entities should have found it, should have been looking. For some, it is literally their job, the media for one. But it's not just the media. Where was Congress? Aren't they constantly shrieking about how they have oversight of the executive branch? Where were they? Well, we know where the Democrats were. They were too busy feeding at the trough to bother to look up. But where were the Republicans this whole time? You can perhaps understand why the media wasn't looking, because they may not have access to the inner workings of agencies or budgets or whatever, or as it turns out, they're being paid by the government not to look. But Congress has oversight. So where were the Republicans? If they have oversight, did they not ever actually look at the line items to even once ask USAID, hey, what's this expenditure here to spend millions on some transsexual performance art in Afghanistan? What's up with that? Did they not bother to ask any questions? And even inside the executive branch itself, there are allegedly safeguards against this kind of fraud. Where were the whistleblowers? Where were the inspectors general? Where were the audits that are supposed to be happening? Sitting by watching trillions of dollars go flooding out the door with no idea where it was going is not a rounding error. Instead, as we're seeing with the Treasury Department itself, actual safeguards were removed. The most basic measures of basic accounting were not being used. Checks were sent out with no notations of what the check was for. No account tracking codes. Not even purpose codes. We've wondered who was in charge when Dementia Joe was resident. The answer is no one. No one was in charge, and everyone was in charge. Everyone just did whatever they wanted, with no one above them saying stop. That is corruption on an unimaginable scale. Thankfully, the great detangling is underway, or trying to be underway, because activist judges who are obviously part of the corruption, either directly or indirectly, are trying to stop anyone from ending the corruption, or even exposing it. There's a great meme out there that says it all. When you're finding fraud and somebody yells stop, that's who's doing the fraud. Today's show is going to look at the executive orders that Trump is issuing at a furious rate and the judges who are yelling stop to prevent the Trump administration from exposing and ending the corruption. That will be in the second half of our show, and we'll do that with James Herson. But first up, we're going to talk about some incredible wins and changes already underway thanks to those executive orders. And one in particular will not be trickle down, it will be a boulder rolling downhill and cause an avalanche of prosperity. To talk about that and some of these other exciting executive orders, I'd like to welcome back Craig Rucker. He is the president and co-founder of CFACT, that's the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Craig, it is great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's always a pleasure being on your program.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You know, in prepping for the show, I got to thinking this has got to be some pretty exciting times for you and everyone there at CFACT, as what you've advocated for so long is being proven true, that the things like America has always had access to abundant energy, but we've chosen not to access it. But even worse, we've replaced abundant energy sources with less efficient things like wind and solar, which are also being not only proven to be inefficient, but to not be green. And all of that mindset has done is driven up costs for everyone, homes and businesses, and enriching the right kinds of people, meaning people on the left. And especially with this flurry of executive orders and stuff that have been released, I mean, you guys must have to be popping champagne like every day.
Oh, yeah. It's exactly been like that, Mark. Every day has been Christmas for us, for the most part, because what we've been talking about for years has actually coming to be. Yes. We finally have a president in there that actually is tackling the global warming / climate change hysteria and showcasing it for the world. And I think providing leadership in the world, yes, to try and roll back some of the nonsense. And it's catching fire. I mean, you have the president of Argentina, of course, pulling out of the last UN meeting which was in Azerbaijan that we were at, based on Trump, conversation with him. You're seeing it now in Hungary and their resistance to trying to go down the EU net zero path. And I think it's going to just catch fire everywhere. So I am very happy with this. And it's been a long time coming, but thank God it's here.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, last week when we were planning on talking to you, we had really thought we'd be zeroing in on a lot of these exciting executive orders that have happened in this whirlwind last couple of weeks. But then there was one in particular that came out that would have come out actually after we would have talked to you. And that's this executive order that established the National Energy Dominance Council. And I think that's going to end up taking up a lot of our discussion today. But before we get to that, are there any executive orders in particular that really got your attention?
Yeah, I would say there's a few that we've been working on. One was the rolling back of electric vehicles, trying to undo those mandates. That's something we've been working on a lot. And, you know, car companies are still losing all sorts of money. I forget how much Ford just lost again in the last quarter, but yeah. They were under pressure from the Biden administration to get, you know, some over 60% of their car fleets turned electric, though nobody was moving them off the lot. So we were encouraged to see that abandoned. We were very excited about offshore wind, the moratorium. As we've chronicled, there's at least 22 projects that were grounded to a halt as a result of them. Nine are still continuing on, and we're going to focus our attention trying to get the administration to stop those as well. But reviewing the permitting, which was rushed through under Biden, which didn't look at the environmental impacts of things like marine mammals and whales and things of that sort that were normally you would think a Democrat would be very concerned about, but they would just brush past those and sped up to try to get 30 gigawatts of offshore wind by the year 2030. So him rolling that back, I think, has been greeted with big cheers. Getting out of the Paris Accords was certainly something we've been working on for a long time. Of course, we were out of the Paris Accords during his first administration, and Biden promptly got us back in. Our hope is that he'll put this before the Senate. It'll be rejected because they need 2/3. I don't even think they'll get 50%. And then this thing is permanently off the table for the next president to come in. So I just think those are ones that in particular caught our attention.
Mm.
As well as calling for a national energy emergency, which led to this Energy Dominance Council that you're talking about. I think that that was also something that we've been working on for a number of years. We actually have in CFAC something called the Net Zero Reality Coalition, comprised of scientists, technicians, engineers, a lot of them policy experts as well, saying that our grid was under threat from all these renewables and intermittent energy sources and the retiring of reliable power plants that rely on coal and natural gas and hydropower. I mean, Biden just really ripped our infrastructure to shreds.
Yes.
And we were in a position where we might be actually experiencing blackouts, brownouts, of course, exorbitantly expensive and unreliable electricity. So I think we're setting a new course, and the people he's put in place with Doug Burgum at Interior and Chris Wright at Energy, and of course, Zeldin at EPA, I think they're going to get it done.
Oh, I certainly think so, too. And we definitely want to come back around to the threat to the grid and all of that, because when you look back at it now, it was pretty clear that he was paving the way, he meaning Biden, was paving the way for China to win, not for us to win for sure. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back. We will be talking about that National Energy Dominance Council. This is exciting. An executive order just established that barely a week ago. We'll take a deeper look with Craig Rucker. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Craig Rucker. He is the co-founder and president of CFAC. That's the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. You can find out more about the great work they do over at CFAC.org. And so, Craig, we left that last segment there leading into the National Energy Dominance Council that was established by an executive order on Friday, February 14th. And this is incredibly exciting. It's going to be chaired by Doug Burgum. He's the Secretary of Interior, and also Chris Wright, who's the Secretary of Energy. But they've got Lee Zeldin of the EPA and a couple of other guys in there as well. Sean Duffy, the Transportation Secretary. I forget the other one offhand, but I think one of the things that is so exciting is it recognizes the fact that America has an abundance of energy, something that we've known for some time, but for some reason we have chosen not to access that. And there was this really interesting quote from, I believe it was Doug Burgum, and he said this, and we're also in an AI arms race with China. And the only way we win that is with more electricity, and we also have an energy emergency in terms of electricity, too much intermittent, unreliable, not enough baseload, and we've been shutting down the baseload that we have. President Trump is going to reverse that, and that's going to allow us to win the AI arms race, which is the most important thing that we have to do relative to our future. And that tapped into exactly what you were saying, is that we have, well, we, meaning Biden, was taking so much of our electricity offline, was replacing it with the intermittent solar and wind, which comes from China. So it's like the Biden administration was maybe susceptible to things like bribes from China, because they were certainly gearing the way for China to win this arms race.
No question. In fact, we were kind of outsourcing most of our critical electricity needs to China because of the fact that by going to renewables, of course, a lot of that's comprised of rare earth elements that mm-hmm. are mined, if not in China directly, sometimes using slave labor, Uyghur labor, they would get it from places like Africa and the Congo, which is, of course, cobalt. And they would use child labor in many cases to go down into the mines to get it. And from our perspective, it was a great change and really encouraging to hear that we're moving away from that expensive, unreliable energy to things that we have in abundance. We have tons of coal. We have tons of natural gas. Yes. We have lots of hydro in the Northwest. We have nuclear technologies that have come online that are far superior to what they had back in the days of the China syndrome. We should be pursuing all these, and mm-hmm. it sounds like we're just about to do that. And of course, one thing people don't understand is that when you go to renewable energy, whether it's solar or wind, you're looking at probably 25 to 35% of the time, they're actually operating at what they say they will,
right.
Which means upwards of 70% of the time they're not. So you still have to rely on that base load. So decommissioning the coal and natural gas plants that they've been doing, and even some of the nuclear plants and other things, where are you going to get that from? Because if you're doing an AI revolution, those are very energy intensive. We have one out here in Virginia that they're trying to do, and Dominion Energy, being kind of woke, is going with offshore wind. But it's not going, as I say, that's only 25-35%. It's woefully insufficient for what they're expecting if this is going to kind of be a Silicon Valley of the East. Chris Wright, to his credit, did something very wise. He wound up prioritizing on the grid for PJM, which is Pennsylvania and Jersey, Maryland, which is a big RTO over here that regulates the electricity grid. He said that the base load gets priority over the renewables, and he's doing that wisely because of the AI centers and other things that are coming in, realizing that if we're going to have those, you can't be, forcing utilities to buy renewables when they happen to be available, which is often at inconvenient times when you don't need them, over our baseload power. So if he continues to do this across the country, I think this is going to have real benefits to businesses and consumers in keeping prices down and making the electricity stable.
Hmm. Well, we know how some states here in the United States, like Oregon, and California and New York State, they've embraced this notion of net zero. But then you look at what's happening across the world, and you've got places like Britain that has really embraced net zero, and they're trying to do things, I think, by 2030 to get to that. And so when you compare what they're doing and how they're effectively making themselves uncompetitive, they're not going to be able to compete in things like AI and some of these other power-hungry industries. So do you think this is going to have a major rollover to places like Britain, which has gone whole hog for this?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, it will. We've already seen actually Europe backtracking because all that renewables did, they had an energy agenda program, for example, in Germany. When they found that that failed, they wound up going with natural gas imports from Russia. When the Ukraine war broke out, they wound up plowing some of their solar fields over and reconstructing coal plants because they weren't able to provide. There were protests among farmers and the like. I don't know as though it's been actually understood by the leadership, political leadership. I mean, I don't think Tina Kotek or Bob Ferguson up in Washington have a clue. I mean, you see them very upset over the dodgy cuts, going for things like Washington Department of Commerce was locked out of $156 million for the Solar for All program. And they're up there. Washington Senator Patty Murray is demanding funding for that. Or, you know, they're upset about the Department of Transportation up in Washington losing $102 million for electric vehicle programs, which is to put in charging stations and things, especially when the companies are now backtracking on all that. They still seem intent, and Newsom himself is trying to, you know, Trump-proof California from all the cuts on these Green New Deal type programs. They still seem like they're either going to replace it with state funding or forge ahead with their foolish plans. So I don't see good things happening on the West if they prevail in this. And some lower courts are, of course, also intervening themselves to try and stop, you know, some of these withdrawals of funds. So they may have to go through their own kind of European experience like Germany did. Before they learn their lesson that these things are not going to work.
No. Well, and they're certainly making their states less competitive for things that are going to be very lucrative in the near future, that AI and data and all the rest. They're essentially taking themselves out of that race. Well, I think we're up against a break here, so let's go ahead and do that. We'll continue our discussion with Craig Rucker, talking about the National Energy Dominance Council. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're on our final segment now with Craig Rucker. We've been talking about the National Energy Dominance Council. And if you'd like to find out more about the great work that Craig Rucker does as over at CFACT, he's their president and co-founder. You can head to CFACT.org. That's CFACT.org. And we'll put that up on today's page on iSpy Radio, which is going to be show 15-08. And Craig, just to continue this discussion about the National Energy Dominance Council, and also one of the things that we're going to have on our show notes page is it's a 30-minute clip, but the comments there from the various secretaries only takes up about 10 minutes, but then Trump gets into some other issues too that are equally exciting, and we'll have that up on the show page as well. Here was one of the things that I thought was just really astounding from Doug Burgum, and he says that the Interior has 500 million acres of surface, 700 million acres of subsurface, and that's minerals, you know, the various critical minerals, and also offshore, close to 2 billion acres. And that's an incredible balance sheet when it comes to energy, and yet we're relying on this ridiculous intermittent energy sources that come from China. It's astounding that we haven't tapped into all of that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. What's funny is a lot of the rare earths that we might need, even if we did decide to go down the foolish path of renewables, we could get a lot of that material from some of those places that Burgum mentioned. But of course, the Greens are against it. They want to keep it in pristine wilderness, untouched, undeveloped. In fact, one of the first things that former President Biden did was take off the table a lot of these areas from any sort of extraction, yes, energy development, and the like.
Yep.
And that was actually reversed. Now, Biden was quick to point out during the campaign that, in fact, there was more offshore oil. There's more fracking, there's more natural gas and everything under his administration. But that was in spite of the activities that he did, not because of them. What Trump had put in his first time was to open that all up, and they were able to continue that on private lands principally, but they were not able to expand on that. The beauty of this new Energy Dominance Council is they're going to return to what Trump did back in the past. And I think they're going to open up a lot more leasing, a lot more tracks for development on federal lands. And I just think you're going to see an energy renaissance burgeon like you've never done before.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Lee Zeldin of the EPA said nearly that exact same thing. He said, the golden age of American success is upon us. If you're excited about the last 3 weeks, that was just a taste of the main event, the entree to come. And the next 4 years will be the greatest presidential term in the history of American presidencies. In terms of the entree to come, do you know or have any guesses at what he's hinting at?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. One of the things they did actually right away gives us a hint is that Biden, of course, in constricting our energy, stopped all liquid natural gas exports. And that has been reversed already by Chris Wright coming in. And I think there's, you know, we're going to now have ability to, you know, start shipping energy as well as just produce it for our own. So I think that both what we can produce domestically and for ourselves can also be money coming into the United States from other parts of the world, especially Europe, which is in desperate need of the natural gas that we have. So I think that's going to create all sorts of jobs here. Unlike renewable energy, which was the route that Biden was going. If you look at the companies that were putting in our solar and wind farms, there are companies like Equinor, Ørsted, British Petroleum. They were all European firms, and the minerals were coming from China. This is made in America energy that will be giving Americans jobs and exporting around the world. It's likely to be a big boom, just that one sector alone, to our whole economy.
Hmm. Well, we've often heard the phrase trickle-down economics. You know, it's a Reagan-era term. This is, if we can really unleash energy the way that they're talking about, this is more like a boulder rolling down the hill, the avalanche effect. I mean, when you think about how expensive energy is right now, and I hear people that just have astronomical energy bills for their houses, I mean, when we can get far less expensive energy costs, I just think that's going to have an enormous impact on the economy as a whole, especially when you consider the fact that if you're spending $500 more on utilities than you ought to be if there was fair pricing involved by using abundant energy, think of what else you could be spending that on. I mean that is a boost to the average household of $6,000 per year just with that. And in fact, Trump, in those comments there that I mentioned, he also talked about one of the things that I think is also setting up kind of a weird dichotomy. You've got places like New York State, among other blue states, that want this net zero garbage. But he wants to try to set up a meeting with the governor there because there's this pipeline that they're looking at establishing. And it would be not just for New York State, but also some of the other New England states as well. And in the comments, he said it could reduce utility bills by up to 50%. So, I mean, that really puts the strain on New York governor there. Because on the one hand, she wants all this net zero garbage, which is punishing ratepayers. But now Trump is coming in with, hey, I can give your ratepayers 50% off. That's going to be a hard thing for her to deal with.
It is. And they have resisted it. And we fought for those pipelines ourselves, arguing for them. But a lot of the citizens and their politicians up there don't. In fact, they even resorted to getting their natural gas from Russia for a while, even in the midst of the Ukraine war, as opposed to having a pipeline go up there. At some point, you got to wonder what they're thinking. I mean, New York State's also sitting on an incredible, I think it's the Marcellus Shale that they have up there that could be making Pennsylvania look like a pauper compared to what they have in New York State, yet they refuse to open up their state to any sort of fracking. I'm originally from Buffalo. My cynical part of me, and actually that's where the governor is too from, part of me says that the reason that for this is that a lot of these energy jobs tend to be more conservative. You've seen Pennsylvania, for example, swing from kind of a light blue state to more of a moderate state as its energy sector has developed. And I think there's a little bit of fear among some of these liberal politicians up in New York that if the fracking boom actually takes place in New York and they're able to get this cheap energy and stuff, that the dynamics of that state may change, and they'd rather keep it, a dark blue state than even threaten anything about that. So, again, I'm reading motives into this, but there's no logical reason for them to oppose this pipeline or developing their energy sector in New York when they are so rich in it.
You're right, there's no logical reason, but I wonder, as we continue to see Doge do its investigations, if there's going to be all these payments uncovered. And that would certainly provide the explanation. As with so much of the Trump presidency, there's tons more to talk about. We'll just have to leave it there. Craig, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, Mark, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Tim Pearson is a New York Times bestselling author, international business attorney, news analyst, cultural commentator, and social media scholar. He's also a frequent guest on iSpy Radio, but never frequent enough. James, it is good to talk to you today.
good to be with you, Mark. And in the golden age, you know, it's a great way to begin it.
That is absolutely true. It has been an exciting first month here for the Trump administration. We wanted to have you on to talk about these activist judges who are trying to thwart democracy. Sure. And you have an article dealing with this subject up on jamesherson.com talking about Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship and the judge who temporarily blocked that. But I'd actually like to start with a little civics lessons that White House spokesman Stephen Miller gave to the media. So let me read this and then get your thoughts on it. He said this, in the Constitution, Article 2, it has a clause known as the vesting clause, and it says the executive power shall be vested in a president, singular. The whole will of democracy is imbued into the elected president. That president appoints staff to then impose that democratic will onto the government. The threat to democracy, the existential threat to democracy, is the unelected bureaucracy of lifetime tenure civil servants who believe they answer to no one, who believe they can do whatever they want without consequence, who believe they can set their own agenda no matter what Americans vote for. So Americans vote for radical FBI reform and FBI agents say they don't want to change, or Americans vote for radical reform in our energy policies, but EPA bureaucrats say they don't want to change either. What President Trump is doing is he's removing federal bureaucrats who are defying democracy by failing to implement his lawful orders, which are of the whole American people. And I think that is the uproar that we're seeing in a nice, neat nutshell. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I love that segment. Stephen Miller is one of my heroes, and that he really encapsulated, actually, he mentioned civics, but it's really the foundation of understanding the Constitution and understanding American law to understand. And what he's talking about is that, you know, and everybody learns this in civics, there's three branches of government. They're co-equal branches, and they're filled with elected officials and appointed people that work for them. They've grown too large. The largest of them is the executive branch. And the only person, the only official where the entire population of the United States is involved with his or her selection is the president. And that's what Article 2, the second article of the Constitution, it says all authority to run that branch, the executive branch, is vested in this one person, the president. And this person, the current president, President Trump, campaigned very publicly, more so than almost anyone in history, with all these rallies that were televised. And standing next to him toward the end of his campaign was Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was President Trump who talked about government efficiency and establishing a new entity to help us with government efficiency. It was a key part of his campaign, and it overlaps with other parts of his campaign. And of course, the American people not only liked it, but they gave him the most decisive victory in modern times because he got the trifecta and he won all the swing states. And he did this despite a revolution in electoral processes which was anti-democratic, which changed our voting procedure across the country, added mail-in ballots, added voting before and after Election Day, told the American people that things that like voter IDs are actually voter suppression,
yeah.
Absurd. But it's all part of the reason that President Trump won so decisively is people want a return to normalcy. And these people who are yelling loudly about constitutional crises actually ignore the fact that we all knew we were in a fiscal crisis.
Yeah,
I mean,
we're 36. We're $36 trillion in debt. Something has to change here, and I think that's what people were voting for sure. Before we run out of time in this segment, you have a great article dealing with one of these executive orders that an activist judge has already jumped in on, And the moment Trump issued it, we all knew that was going to be the case. And it was an executive order ending birthright citizenship. And a judge has already tried to stay that. So go ahead and fill us in on what's happening there.
Well, that's the one where when people listen to local news programming and cable shows, they hear supposed legal experts telling them, well, this one is a loser for Trump because this is the way it was always done. And if we look at the language of the Constitution, that if someone comes here and they have a child, that child is a citizen. And that is false. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that children of people who come here illegally shall be citizens. There is nothing in any Supreme Court case in history that says that. Hmm. It's another canard where they've just done it, and it's been done for a while. It's true that it's been done for a long time, but it is not settled law, and there's never been a case before the Supreme Court dealing with the question of whether a couple that comes into the United States illegally and has a child, whether that child should be granted citizenship. And if anything, looking at the history, the legislative history of the 14th Amendment, which started out as legislation by Congress and then became the 14th Amendment, we have all kinds of historical documents. That was not the original intent. No way. As a matter of fact, they specifically denied this so-called birthright citizenship to groups based on whether they had political loyalty to the United States. And it is absurd, the kind of reporting we've seen, but we're getting used to this, you know, that we can't trust the media. But this judge, this was probably the safest of all the activist judge ruling, because literally the entire legal academia are on the side of the judge and all the media is on the side of the judge. Well, I guess that's true of all the activist judges.
Yeah, really.
But anyway, this if we follow the law, President Trump will win on this one as well as the other ones that we're going to discuss.
Yeah.
This is basically the only branch that the left can go to now is the judicial branch. And they've done this forever. We, just like every other institution in our country, our legal institutions have been infiltrated and revolutionized with a kind of a moral and legal anarchy.
Yeah, and it really is kind of interesting that the people that are screaming about the end of democracy simply aren't following democracy when you look at what Stephen Miller there said about Article 2. All right, it is time for a break. Everyone stay with us. Coming up, and we'll talk about what to do about those judges. Stay with us. And we're back to talk to David James Hurston. He's perhaps best known for his best-selling book, Tales from the Left Coast, that exposed the insanity inside Hollywood. You can find his latest articles on jameshurston.com. We just got done talking about one of those, dealing with the birthright citizenship issue. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people asking the same questions about these unelected judges that are throwing themselves on these executive order hand grenades that Trump has thrown out there, that if an unelected judge can just come in and effectively undo the will of the people, undo the elections, the desire of the people, then what's the point of bothering with elections?
Exactly. The same people who scream about existential threats to democracy have come up with the ultimate existential threat. We have to understand our federal courts are divided into three prongs. There's a district court, which is a trial court, the lowest level. Then there's an appellate level, and then there's the Supreme Court. Now, at the district level, the courts are designed to deal with local issues. So that's why you see this. They run to a blue state Obama-appointed judge, as they did one time during Trump's first term. They ran to a judge in Hawaii who issued an injunction that would affect the entire country. That is insane.
Yes.
And so that's what's happened here. We have, for example, I think the most ridiculous one is this example that the judge in New York said that the Secretary of the Treasury, that's newly appointed Scott Bessent, approved, that he can't look at the records of the Treasury. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, how insane.
You know, as we talked about in the last segment, Article 2 of the Constitution makes the president the boss of the executive branch, a co-equal branch of government. He's the boss. Mm-hmm. He's responsible. The buck stops here. Are you going to tell me the boss can't look at his fiscal records? That's a significant, elementary, fundamental task of any boss. So the president and his cabinet and his appointed agents have to be able to audit the records. And what's really outrageous about this New York judge is that he issued a ruling. It's called ex parte.
Yes.
Which means there was no hearing, that the president was given no opportunity to present his point of view or his lawyers present briefs and argue their briefs. And you only do an ex parte ruling like that as a judge in a very urgent emergency. And so this judge has committed just blatant judicial malpractice. This will be overturned. I think it may be overturned by the appellate division, because, you know, this idea that if I am the president and I bring in someone and appoint them, that's not unusual in the government of the United States in any administration. As a matter of fact, every approved cabinet member brings in all kinds of employees mm-hmm. that have access to these same
sure.
records. And it's interesting. This judge made no sense. His reasoning made no sense. There's no legal theory that justifies this.
No.
And what he essentially is saying, the duly approved Secretary of the Treasury cannot look at his own records, but the bureaucrats, the lifetime bureaucrats who are unelected, can't.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if there's ever a case of here's some clear and compelling evidence of fraud and we don't want you to look at it, I mean, there it is. That's the message they're sending. As far as that being overturned and when that's overturned, can the next level of court there, the circuit court, can they somehow slap that judge at all, or at least give him some sort of spanking?
Well, they slap. I mean, having something overturned and having an appellate judge say that basically you have just what I just said, that there was no legal theory, no legal right. What you've done is judicial malpractice. And under normal circumstances, that is a slap. It harms their reputation. But the problem is these, and particularly these President Obama appointed judges, don't seem to care about that. So the only remedy given to us with the federal judiciary is impeachment. And the problem with that is that requires Congress to act, to go through the process of impeachment. And that doesn't mean they shouldn't do it. I think a part of the agenda, and as we know, President Trump has a very full plate, and each of his cabinet heads have a very full plate, and the Congress has a full plate, but they should make an example. This guy would be a good one to make an example of, but there's plenty of others. And to show how crazy the left is, they shop around and they look for judges that they think are going to not follow the law. And of course, they went to Judge Chutkan, who was a part of the lawfare against Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and they were trying to get another one of these injunctions to block them from accessing three agencies. And even, it made me at least say, hey, there are some judges that say, okay, we're not going along.
Right.
There's no law. So Chutkin refused to give that TRO, which shocked the media, shocked the left, shocked me.
Well, and it shocked me too, but I would like to think that that means that, hey, these judges are starting to get the message here, is that they really can't throw themselves in front of the will of the people. All right, it is time for a break. We'll wrap things up with James Hurston after this. And welcome back in our final segment now with James Hurston. He's an international business attorney, news analyst, cultural commentator, social media scholar, and New York Times bestselling author. You can find his terrific articles by heading to jameshurston.com. Hurston is H-I-R-S-E-N. jameshurston.com. We'll link that up on today's show page, which is 15-08 on iSpyRadio.com. And, you know, going on to that last segment there, we're talking about impeaching these judges. And I certainly hope that that may happen with some of the worst of these, because if nothing else, it sends a message. And then it will also expose the Democrats who are will have to then vote and say, no, I'm totally in favor of fraud and keeping that. And speaking of exposing fraud, we got just a taste of what the CIA was doing through USAID. We're spending tens of billions of dollars on just some of the insanity over there. And then as they rolled into these other agencies like the Treasury Department, which had some $4 trillion in untraceable payments, the Democrats just kept shouting, oh, don't look over there. And then Doge immediately found a fraud when they said, don't look over there. I mean, it's almost been comical. And one such area they really did not want to be examined was Social Security, which made the fraud by USAID pale in comparison. $1.2 trillion of Social Security payments were sent overseas. But one that you would think that would have the Democrats upset is this notion that Doge uncovered some 12.4 million people on Social Security who were over 120 years old. But for some reason, the Democrats are upset that they're even looking at such things. I don't get why they've staked out this moral position that anyone looking for fraud ought to be stopped from looking. Do they really think that's a winning position?
Yeah, you know, when thieves are about to be caught, they start screaming very loudly. And that's what's happening. I mean, we're seeing, you know, when you have a banana republic and you have a dictator who is thrown out, they usually find out that he stole the treasury. And we thought there was some corruption, but I think everyone is shocked at what we're uncovering, that what Elon Musk and Doge is uncovering. And they're doing the job just a bit too well for the Democratic Party. Yes. And what does the Democratic Party do? They go right to Alinsky methods, the rules for radicals technique. And one of the things Alinsky did is pick a person and demonize them. And that's what they're doing with Elon Musk, who is a guy just a few years ago was given the Person of the Year from Time magazine. And everybody loved him because they thought he was liberal. And this the wealthiest, and I would argue the most successful man in business, is Elon Musk, and one of the most creative geniuses of our time. He's joined together with the toughest guy in the world and most powerful, President Trump, and it's unstoppable. And every time they attack Musk and they call him a racist and they call him names, they have these protests. He smiles. He's a happy warrior. And it's amazing that it reminds me, this is another Alinsky technique, communist technique, and we've seen it all the time, that is to accuse your opponent of what you are doing. So this, the existential threat to democracy they tried while they were destroying our republic. And this is the constitutional crisis that they are pointing their finger at Elon Musk and President Trump is exactly what they are doing. They're interfering with the electoral will of the people, as we discussed with that Stephen Miller soundbite, you know, and it's there's an irony to it.
Yeah.
But the people clearly want this quest for efficiency. President Trump talked about it. And so they're going to use every tool in their toolbox to oppose it because in many cases their rear ends are on the line.
Oh, absolutely. But what I think is really telling right now is there's a perceptible societal shift happening where, you know, like when, for example, when the Democrats were first protesting USAID and saying, oh, we're cutting off all these aid programs for these people that really need it, kids are starving and so on, they had some pretty decent crowds there. And then they started protesting at the Treasury and there were fewer there. And then just Thursday, they were protesting outside the FBI and there was no one. There were just the five senators there. And so clearly this is not a winning issue. So I guess the bigger question here is, now that all of this corruption is being exposed, why aren't they joining in?
Yeah, well, of course we know because they've been part of it. And there's plenty. It's a uniparty activity. The USAID, we've seen money going to entities that are associated with children of famous leaders. We've heard of a lot of Democrats. We also know that there are Democrats that inexplicably their net worth explodes while they're in office. And there's a whole list of them. That's another thing DOGE is going after.
Yep.
And all of those Democrats whose net worth has exploded, who appear to have entities that are getting these kickbacks, they're the loudest.
Yes,
they're the ones that are screaming.
But, you know, that's really an opportunity for them. Is if you've been guilty of fraud, now's the chance. Now's your chance to step forward to help expose that. And I would like to think that some of them are smart enough to do that. I'm not convinced that they are, but that's what they ought to be doing. James, unfortunately, we are up against the clock here with you. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
You know, I raised the point there that there's an opportunity for Democrats to join in and help Republicans to find and get rid of the fraud, waste, and abuse. Instead, they are trying to stop it in the judiciary, in congressional hearings, and even trying to sabotage things from within the presidential administration. In fact, when you think about it, why haven't they pointed out fraud that benefits Republicans? With all of those trillions of dollars being wasted on Democrat causes, why are we, so far, not seeing any such fraud and waste and abuse that benefits Republican causes? Where are the hundreds of billions of dollars going toward pro-life issues? The hundreds of billions of dollars going to churches to help spread Christianity? Where are the hundreds of billions of dollars going to the National Rifle Association? We have said nearly from the beginning of I Spy Radio 15 years ago that if you wanted to stop leftist Marxist ideology, take away their public funding. And finally, we're beginning to see that, but the important thing is to not let up. Let your representatives know that you are 100% in favor of cutting this fraud and waste. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.